Hello and welcome to the Microbiomedics podcast. I'm Dr. Siobhan McCormack.
And I'm Dr. Sheena Fraser, and we're your co-hosts.
We are both GPs and lifestyle medics with a shared passion for microbiome science, and we have spent the last 5 years deep diving into the world of the gut microbiome. We'll be translating the evidence and packaging it into actionable, bite-sized chunks so that you can harness the power of the microbiome to improve your own health and that of your patients.
Just before we start this interview, we'd like to remind our listeners to take a look at the Gut Microbiome for Clinicians course. It's available through bslm.org.uk. It's a comprehensive course on the gut microbiome, which takes you from the basics to the clinical application of this fascinating new area of medicine. This course will empower you to use microbiome science in your daily practice.
Hello and welcome. My name is Dr. Siobhan McCormack, and I'm joined by my fellow microbiome medic, Dr. Sheena Fraser. In this episode, Sheena and I will be discussing the connection between your gut microbiota and your brain and how this might impact your experience of pain. We're going to explore ways in which your bacteria can talk to your brain, how your brain can talk back, and how these conversations might impact our behaviour and our perception of pain. This discussion will lay the groundwork for part two of this exploration into the gut microbiome and pain, when we will be joined by leading UK pain management consultant and author, Dr. Deepak Ravindran, who's translating this evidence into his clinical practice. Sheena, hello. You've been looking into this area. What can you tell us?
Hi, Shiv. Yeah, it is a really interesting area. And yeah, I've been studying it now for a few months. And I guess we studied it way back when we were looking at our gut-brain module as well, gut-brain part of our gut microbiome for clinicians module. And, you know, we looked into it in a reasonable amount of depth at that in those days. But now, you know, we're taking it a wee bit further now, and we're going into a greater depth with this and really looking at the interplay between the gut microbes and the brain. And so, yeah, I've been really looking forward to covering this. And I think, you know, people have been interested in us covering this, and we've had requests for that from our listeners. Why do we look at this area? Well, you know, the gut and the brain is becoming very, very popular. We realize now that, you know, the things that we do to our gut actually does influence the brain. And up until now, we've predominantly been practicing our pain management using a sort of pain ladder, which we know as medics to be a sort of utilizing medication predominantly to manage pain. If you're fortunate, you might get a bit of physio to manage pain. And if you're even more fortunate, you might get some psychological therapy to help with your pain management if you have any chronic pains. But enhancing and manipulating the gut microbiome has never really been part of pain management guidelines. So I hope that in these two episodes, we're going to slightly change the perspective on this. And hopefully clinicians will consider the gut-brain axis and the gut microbiota as being slightly more important than they have done up until now. So we've got lots to get through in this episode, Shiv, and I want to really sort of start at the beginning and work out how your gut microbiota and gut microorganisms can actually communicate with nerve cells. So we're assuming in this episode that our listeners will understand the basics of the gut microbiome, but we're also assuming that you know what gut dysbiosis is and what leaky gut means. And if you don't know that, please go back and listen to our previous episodes, because that will fill you in on these things so that we don't have to explain them in more depth in this episode. This story begins before birth, within the yolk sac, where you've got these incredible specialized macrophages. And macrophages are cells of the innate immune system, which is the bit that actively sort of surveys the body for harmful pathogens or damaged cells. And these cells are called microglia. And microglia are specialists in looking after the neurons in the brain. So before the blood-brain barrier forms, these microglia migrate to the embryonic brain, so the very early, early brain. And they play a lead role in architecting the nerve cells and the neurons. They're also capable of turning inflammation on or off when it's required within the brain. There's some other important cells that we need to bear in mind as well, called astrocytes. And astrocytes are a type of nerve cell, which are essential for normal brain function. But they also help to maintain the blood-brain barrier, which is this incredible barrier, much like the barrier in the gut. It's a very active barrier. Siobhan's going to tell us a little bit more about that in a wee bit. But essentially, if you think about the endothelial barrier in the gut that we've already talked about, how it's able to sort of let certain things through but not others, the blood-brain barrier is very similar. It's the barrier between the blood and the brain itself, the central nervous system, and it exists all around the brain. And it essentially lets the important things in and hopefully doesn't let the harmful bacteria or harmful toxins into the brain. So they're important, and they're an essential form of defense for the brain to prevent infections and damage from toxins. And there's other key players in the gut-brain connection. So the vagus nerve, which travels from the gut to the brain, acts as an information highway between the two organs. And the peripheral nerves, which transmit information back and forth from the peripheries of the body, and also the enteric nervous system, which we know exists within the gut itself, which is one of the biggest and more complex nervous systems in the body. And the information can travel from the enteric nervous system via the vagus nerve up to the brain. So what I wanted to do now, Shiv, is I wanted to go through some of these areas in a little bit more depth. So Shiv, you've looked at how we communicate between the gut and the brain. Can you just talk us through some of the mechanisms that this happens?
Yeah, I think it's probably really important for listeners to have a basic understanding of the three main systems that connect the gut to the brain. These three systems are the nervous system, the endocrine system, and the immune system. And this takes place in something that's being dubbed the gut-brain axis. Now, the nervous system in the gut, as you've just said, Sheena, is called the enteric nervous system. It's nicknamed the second brain. That's because it contains a similar number of nerve cells to that of a cat's brain. It's also got a similar number of nerve cells to our spinal cord. So it's highly innervated. But instead of being arranged in one discrete area, it's arranged in a mesh-like sock almost that lines the whole of your gut from your mouth to your anus. So it's there waiting to receive messages and it's throughout the gut. The endocrine system. Now, the gut is the body's largest endocrine organ, and over 30 gut hormones have been identified to date, and they're involved in a huge diversity of roles, including your satiety, energy metabolism, motility, and also pain as well. So the endocrine system releases messenger hormones from the gut into the circulation that can travel to distant tissues. Now, then there's the immune system. It's really important to remember that the gut's the largest surface area between you and the dangers of the outside world. So it's got to be surveyed by your immune system 24/7. And 70% or over 70% of your immune cells reside in your gut in something called the gut-associated lymphoid tissue, or GALT for short. Now, immune system activation triggers a release of various chemicals, including cytokines, which are able to communicate with distant tissues. So these three things, the enteric nervous system, which connects to the vagus nerve, as you've already said, Sheena, the endocrine system, which is the gut's largest, the body's largest endocrine organ containing all these gut hormones, and the immune system, which has 70% of your body's immune cells, makes you realize what an incredibly important area this is. And all these things are able to communicate messages to the gut. So the gut microbiota, these microbes, trillions of microbes, mostly bacteria, residing mostly in your colon, are connected to all three of these. They are able to communicate with your gut nervous system, your gut endocrine system, and your gut's immune system through various molecules and metabolites. Now, one of these metabolites is short-chain fatty acids, which are produced by many bacteria. Now, these not only influence the function of your immune system, they actually influence how your immune system is created from birth and its development. And we know that short-chain fatty acids can influence the maturation of immune cells and which type of immune cells are preferentially produced. We also know that certain bacteria can stimulate the release of gut hormones. And we know that bacteria can synthesize a huge number of neurotransmitters, which are the chemicals used to transmit information through your nervous system. So there are a variety of neurotransmitters, things like dopamine, serotonin, noradrenaline, GABA, glutamate, that can be produced by your bacteria. It's very complex. It's quite a new area of research. But Sheena, can you tell me a bit more about this? Because I think you've looked into the production of some of these neurotransmitters by the colonic bacteria.
Yeah, it is really interesting. And certainly, there's quite a few of these neurotransmitters that are produced by the gut microbiota. When we look at just a couple of examples, we've got glutamate, which is produced by acetate. Now, acetate's one of the short-chain fatty acids, and we get it predominantly from dairy. And it's actually from certain bacteria called lactobacilli, which we know from our fermented foods, and bacterioides, and the Campylobacter jejuni. So these bacteria all produce the glutamate within the gut itself. And this glutamate can transfer intestinal signals to the brain through the vagus nerve. That's quite important for memory, cognition, and mood regulation. But it can't cross the blood-brain barrier itself. But interestingly, acetate can. So acetate can cross the blood-brain barrier and then produce this glutamate neurotransmitter within the brain, which is interesting. And it's a similar story with serotonin, because serotonin is a neurotransmitter which 95% of it is produced in the gut. And that's produced by staphylococcal and clostridial species. But actually, interestingly, that's another one that doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier. And a lot of its action is thought to be within the brain and the pineal gland, where it's sort of it produces melatonin. Melatonin has this action there, and serotonin obviously has a big action in the brain as well. And it's associated with mood disorders, sleep disorders. It's important for digestion, nausea, wound healing, whole host of different things, really. And interestingly, again, you know, that's another one that can be produced within the gut, within the brain. So there's a whole number of neurotransmitters here, lots of them produced by bacteria. And interestingly, if the bacteria produces them in the gut, then they often are transmitting through the vagus nerves and other nerves. But they can actually travel up through the blood as well, and they can directly transmit via the nerves within the brain if they can get through the blood-brain barrier. And if not, then sometimes the precursors, as I said, can get through the blood-brain barrier and create them within the brain. So they're an interesting area, Siobhan. So you're going to move on to short-chain fatty acids?
Yeah, I just wanted to say one thing, because that is an astonishing figure when we talk about over 90% of the body's serotonin being made in the gut. And then when I heard it couldn't go through the blood-brain barrier, you kind of think, well, therefore it doesn't affect the brain. But you've got to remember those are the direct effects of that serotonin on the brain, but it affects the brain function indirectly via its local action in the gut and the surrounding tissue. So it's like there's a big interplay between them. It's not just one thing. Everything is messaging everything else. So it's really complex systems approach you've got to sort of think about here, with all these inputs from lots of different chemical messengers. So it's really difficult to tease out just one thing. But it's incredibly interesting that the bacteria in the gut can produce all the neurotransmitters that we use for our brain function, and all the reasons for that. It's, the evolutionary aspects of it are really interesting.
Absolutely. And it's incredible just how much, you know, when you think about somebody who has depression, for example, or anxiety, we know even historically, you know, back in the 1700s, physicians knew there was a connection between the gut and the brain because they talked about how, you know, people with anxiety or depression often had disrupted gut function. And for something, if you consider serotonin, for example, serotonin actually helps to speed up your gut. So if you are depleted in serotonin, if you're not producing enough of it, then not only are you not communicating to the brain and having that impact on your mood and things, but you're not actually having the direct effects on your gut either. So you end up constipated and you can have problems there with your gut. So you can see how these things are very much connected, and we've kind of always known that the gut and the brain are connected, but when you look at the actions of these neurotransmitters, you can see how they're, you know, so entwined.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you mentioned short chain fatty acids, which are obviously the go-to microbial metabolite that everyone talks about. Butyrate, acetate, propionate are three of the main ones. They make up, I think, about 80% or 90% of the short-chain fatty acids that are produced in the colon. And these are all incredibly important in a, you know, multitude of different ways. And for example, short-chain fatty acids, there are short-chain fatty acid receptors, these G protein-coupled receptors, everywhere in the body, in every organ, including the brain, who are able to sort of accept the ligand, the short-chain fatty acid, which then instigates another action. So the short-chain fatty acids are hugely important as communicators, as signaling molecules all over the body, but, you know, especially in this context with the brain, and, you know, we're talking, or we'll be talking about chronic pain, and how you talked about short chain fatty acids being really important for the production of these neurotransmitters, which I hadn't quite appreciated. What are your thoughts about the short chain fatty acids in regard to brain function and pain?
Yeah, so it's interesting. And if we relate it back to the microglia, so we know that the microglia are very responsive to short chain fatty acids. So if you have enough short chain fatty acids stimulating the microglia, then that really helps the microglia to architect the brain and to keep the brain functioning really healthily, and to, you know, to survey the brain and make sure that you're getting rid of any toxins, getting rid of any damaged cells. So short-chain fatty acids are really important for this function. And interestingly, if you have disruption to short-chain fatty acid production early on in life, you know, in the first 1,000 days of life, with, for example, antibiotic use, C-section birth, or your feeding choice being bottle feeding, you won't produce the same quantity of short chain fatty acids as you would if you were vaginally delivered, birth, breastfed, no exposure to antibiotics. And there's a big difference in the architecture of the brain as a result of that. So it's quite important that we have sufficient short chain fatty acids for these important functions. And if you look at people who suffer from chronic pain, they have been found to have low levels of short-chain fatty acid production. So short-chain fatty acids actually seem to play a role in dampening pain responses, so that you don't, you know, feel pain so acutely if you have a higher quantity of short-chain fatty acids. So you know, if you have a terrible diet, then I think you won't be producing so much short chain fatty acids, and that may then mean that you suffer pain more greatly.
Yeah, I think it's really important, that point about how important the gut microbiota are in the development of our brain function and our immune system, and that, you know, really connects together. And any listeners who are wondering, well, how do we know this? Then that's an excellent question to ask. A lot of our studies are actually animal studies in germ-free mice. These mice have been specially bred to have no microbes. So they have no microbes anywhere. And that means they have no microbiome in their gut. And they found that these mice have very different brain structures and a very different immune system. And when they put microbes back into the mice, that this can be partially resolved. But if we look at these germ-free mice, they have poorly produce myelin on their cells. Areas of their brain, such as the hippocampus, are smaller. There's poor neurone development, but there's also poor development of their microglia and astrocytes, and poor development of their immune system as well. So they're much more prone to infections. So there's, from the onset, there's this huge connection between your microbes and your brain development and your immune development. And as you said, Sheena, the first 1,000 days of life for us humans are incredibly important. And we've talked about how important it is to get a good initial gut microbiome composition to try and encourage beneficial bacteria into our gut so that they then go on and educate our immune system to either react or not overreact, but react appropriately to various immune stimuli. So it's really important, that first 1,000 days.
Yeah, and of course, you know, a lot of the studies we're looking at aren't just on animals. You know, we have got data from human studies as well, and especially when we're looking at short chain fatty acid production in a lot of disorders like chronic pain syndromes, and you know, chronic gut disorders, there's lots of evidence based on the quantity of short chain fatty acids that are produced in the guts of individuals with these. So yeah, we've certainly got it from all angles there. But yeah, it's a really, really interesting area. So, you know, short chain fatty acids are massively important. And of course, we get our short chain fatty acids through eating fibrous foods, so your fruits and your vegetables. So that's it's an important thing to maintain within your diet, to get enough of these very important substrates. So Siobhan, what else were you going to tell us about?
Well, I think we're just, because we're going to be moving on, we're trying to set the groundwork for a discussion on pain and chronic pain. I thought it'd be useful just to briefly discuss the difference between them, because we often divide pain into acute pain, which is evolutionary mechanism, which is useful for us. It alerts us to a harmful stimulus, moves us away from that stimulus, protects us from tissue injury, and allows time for healing. This is different from chronic pain, which the International Association for the Study of Pain defines as pain that persists for more than 3 months, and it doesn't have any evolutionary benefit. Chronic pain is a huge issue in the NHS and globally. It's thought that 30% of the population worldwide suffer from some form of chronic pain disorder, which is, I was really surprised at, actually. Now, the mechanisms of chronic pain are incompletely understood, but we do know that inflammation seems to be a key theme. So lots of different stimuli can excite these pain receptors called nociceptors. And including inflammatory molecules can actually excite these pain receptors. And stimulation of these nociceptors releases these neurotransmitters we've been talking about, which alert the central nervous system, microglia and astrocytes, those two important brain cells that you mentioned. And these microglia and astrocytes then trigger a pro-inflammatory response in the brain. So you get infiltration of pro-inflammatory cytokines, chemokines and immune cells, white blood cells and various other immune cells as well. And this is known in the brain as neuroinflammation. Now, short term, again, neuroinflammation appears to be largely protective. It protects us from the host from pathogens. It protects us from toxins. But the concern is this chronic inflammation is a key driver of many brain disorders, including chronic pain. So, so we think that this neuroinflammation is responsible for generating and sustaining the sensitization of our nerves. And that's one of the important things that leads to chronic pain. So I suppose if we're targeting or thinking about chronic pain and targeting neuroinflammation, then we could think about treatments that might be helpful in that regard. So, I mean, Sheena, people could ask at this stage, so what has neuroinflammation got to do with the gut microbiome?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, the inflammation has to start somewhere, and often it is within the gut. So we know, for example, LPS, lipopolysaccharides, which are derived from the breakdown of the wall of gram-negative bacteria. So the more sort of inflammatory, harmful bacteria, the way that they create inflammation often is through the direct impact of LPS. And LPS is really interesting. So it can get through the barrier, the wall of the intestine into the bloodstream by creating inflammation and allowing itself through. And then it can do the same in the brain. So it can create inflammation all over the body, but up in the CNS, it can increase the permeability of the blood-brain barrier, and it can increase the inflammatory response of the microglia and the astrocytes.
Sheena, can I stop you there for a minute? I just wanted to ask you a bit, because I feel I don't know enough about this area, the blood-brain barrier and its permeability and what makes it more permeable. Have you read much about that, or could you enlighten me and the listeners?
So the blood-brain barrier is basically the barrier between the blood and the brain cells. And it's kind of similar. It's got tight junctions, the way that that you have tight junctions in the gut membrane. So these tight junctions are not just, you know, simple junctions. They're actually very complex, and they respond to a whole lot of different signaling and different transmitters and things. So they're able to open up in response to good things that it needs. So it needs energy. The brain needs energy. So it needs molecules that provide energy to be going through. And it also needs a lot of these neurotransmitters, and it needs short chain fatty acids and things. So, you know, these sort of beneficial things should be allowed through, but it doesn't need toxins, and it doesn't need harmful bacteria. So, you know, it needs to be smart enough to not allow these things through. So the tight junctions are very smart, but they can be eroded. And if you have sufficient inflammation within the bloodstream, then of course, in the same way that the gut barrier can be damaged, the blood-brain barrier can become damaged, and you can get leakage of pro-inflammatory substrates like LPS and other toxins produced by bacteria or fungi or viruses through into the brain. So it's an important part of the nervous system and the immune system, and it's very much dependent on signals from the nervous system either side. It's dependent on, you know, the blood itself and what the blood contains, and it's dependent on it's maintained by things like short chain fatty acids, which help to reduce inflammation. So it's quite complex, but responsive, and very changeable in response to different things. So we know that, you know, for example, if you're very, very unhealthy and you have a very unhealthy diet, high fat, high sugar, then you're more likely to have LPS within the brain itself directly affecting the microglia and the astrocytes, and you'll get more inflammation in there. So you are actually allowing the LPS through in these very pro-inflammatory states. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about inflammation in the body. You know, it's these very inflammatory cells that are producing all this inflammation elsewhere, but they often do come from the gut.
Yeah, we always seem to go back to inflammation as being the sort of the common ground that is so critical to the pathogenesis of these non-communicable diseases, including brain disease like Alzheimer's disease, depression, you know, mood disorders, chronic pain, but also this chronic low-grade inflammation that we get in the circulation, which is often related to gut barrier dysfunction. So I suppose it's worth us just, you know, reminding everyone how important the gut barrier is, the largest surface area between you and the outside world, and that it has to be permeable. So you can't have a gut barrier that's completely closed off like a brick wall, because you wouldn't be able to get food and nutrients and water through. So it has to allow the good things through. But what you don't want is the epithelial cells to open up and so widely and permanently that they just let everything through. Because if you think of the traffic going through your gut every day, all sorts of toxins, bacteria, potentially harmful molecules, you don't want that aggravating or getting through into the body and setting off this chain of reaction from the underlying immune cells that are there waiting to be activated if they recognize any potentially dangerous molecules. And I think what seems to be happening with our diet and with the Western diet, where we've got it reduces the number of beneficial bacteria, it reduces short-chain fatty acids, which is hugely important in mucus production and in keeping the lining healthy. It feeds the enterocytes, which are the lining cells of the gut. And if you're reducing the beneficial bacteria and you're producing the beneficial metabolites they're producing, and you're also doing the opposite, you're actually sort of increasing the potentially pathogenic bacteria that are producing all sorts of toxic secondary bile acids. So you're getting a lack of a mucus layer, and you're getting potential toxins being produced. That all damages the gut barrier and allows pathogenic particles to come through and trigger a low-grade inflammation. And instead of an acute inflammation's good, it turns an inflammatory response on that is good to protect you from dangerous particles. But if you've got this kind of slightly lazy, chronic, low-grade inflammation, never quite turning off all the time, that's incredibly aging and damaging to the body in all sorts of ways. It very much mirrors what you were saying about the blood-brain barrier and neuroinflammation, really. What do you think, Sheena?
Absolutely. So it's, and if you look at LPS in particular, it's not just necessarily having its impact on the brain, but also elsewhere. So, other more peripheral nerves, like the trigeminal nerves, for example, have these nociceptors, so these receptors on them that are very responsive to LPS. So LPS has been shown to be quite high in individuals with trigeminal neuralgia, which is a very painful condition, which affects the face, causing really severe chronic pain. So these individuals have a higher level of LPS going around their bloodstream, stimulating these particular nerves. So LPS can directly stimulate pain through that kind of a mechanism, and it can create inflammation, which can stimulate pain, and it can also be quite damaging to short chain fatty acids. And LPS is quite toxic generally to a lot of organisms, so it reduces the beneficial microorganism population and reduces the beneficial neurotransmitter that are produced as well. So there's a whole host of impacts. And so I guess what we're saying is that you can't say there's one particular mechanism that's happening here to create pain, because pain is created through a whole number of different mechanisms. But the big story is that if you have a really healthy gut microbiota, that goes a long way in terms of preventing pain. And so maintaining that healthy gut microbiota throughout your life, I think, is really important, because interestingly, your threshold for pain, so the amount of pain that you experience as a person when you're exposed to painful stimuli, is worse if you are if you have low short-chain fatty acid production and a more dysbiotic gut, than if you have a very healthy gut microbiota with lots of short-chain fatty acids. So all of these things are linked. And of course, we know as microbiomedics that it's not just one thing that creates a healthy gut microbiota. It's a whole number of things, and one thing can be enough to topple it. So if you're chronically stressed, or if you have sleep deprivation, or if you just have a terrible diet, all of these things can really topple your gut microbiota and create that really unhealthy, unbalanced microbiome that puts you more at risk of this. So enhancing your gut microbiome is key.
Yeah, and I think it's a really important point you make there, that you can't just do that by taking a probiotic, because everyone automatically says, well, chronic pain, if you're saying the gut microbiome is involved, then tell me which probiotic I should take. And it's just really important. There is a place for things like probiotics, I'm sure, but you've got to get the foundations right. And it's very similar to the lifestyle medicine approach which, you know, you've got to look at your sleep, you've got to look at your connectivity, at your stress, you've got to look at time in nature, physical activity, and, you know, what you're eating. All of these things and more are important, and you have to take them all into account, and they all affect the microbiota in really positive ways if you get them right. And all of these things make a small amount of difference. And when you add them together, it can be incredibly potent. But I suppose in Western medicine, we're very used to not looking at systems and networks and changing everything at once. It's very much been one pathway from A to B, you know, a drug, and look at what happens. So we're very much primed to just take one thing at a time and then judge about whether it's good or not and throw it away if it's not helpful. It's very much a sort of medication approach. And I think this is very different. I'm really excited to be speaking to, when we speak to Dr. Deepak Ravindran, because he very much incorporates all this into his chronic pain program. And he's looking at all the evidence and trying to incorporate it, you know, from the get-go, really. So, yeah, that will be really interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah. And were you looking at some studies this week, Siobhan?
Yeah. So there's two things I just wanted to bring. Just talking about Dr. Deepak, I just finished his book, The Pain-Free Mindset, which 7 Steps to Taking Control and Overcoming Chronic Pain. It's published by Penguin Random House. It's brilliant. It's brilliant for listeners, whether you've got pain or not. It's brilliant for all medics, because he has a really good way of communicating the science, which you'll hear when you listen to the next episode of this podcast. But also in a book, because I just don't know, I'm really struggling in general practice at the moment. You know, we have 10 or 15 minutes with a patient who's come in with multiple problems, and you've really got to respect your patients, what they've come in for. It's their time. And, you know, I've got so many other things I'd love to discuss with them, but we're just so time limited. But to have this, you know, genius book that basically is like a course, a sort of, it explains, it gives you a toolkit for overcoming or living with chronic pain and improving your perception of chronic pain. It's absolutely brilliant. It's like an action plan. And I highly recommend it for anyone who is suffering from chronic pain, because if you do follow what he says in the book, you know, I really, really will help you. But the other paper I brought, because talking about this brings you on to things like an anti-inflammatory diet when people with chronic pain, that's one of the things they're told to look at. And it all gets very muddled. You know, what's a gut microbiome diet? What's an anti-inflammatory diet? What's a Mediterranean diet? But actually, all of these things as key components, which are important to all of them. So I just found this paper, which I liked, called The Effect of an Anti-Inflammatory Diet on Chronic Pain. It's a pilot study by Sala Clement et al. And it was published in Frontiers in Nutrition in July 2023. It's a very small study. And that's important as well, because these studies in nutrition are hugely expensive. There's no big drug companies funding them. So they are very difficult and complex to do. Teasing out all the mechanisms is very difficult. But they were looking at chronic pain in rheumatic diseases. And it's really sort of divided into two parts, which I thought were quite interesting. First of all, they did a systematic review of the literature, looking at all the things they could find that had a really good evidence base behind them at reducing chronic pain. A lot of it is based on a lot of the chronic pain studies and diet being done on the Mediterranean diet. So they looked at all these things and they collated 13-item anti-inflammatory diet guide based on the Mediterranean diet. So it was for rheumatic disease patients who are often really poorly in a lot of pain and have a lot of autoimmune problems as well. So it was quite strict. So it was out without red meat, gluten or cow's milk. But all the usual suspects were there. So high fruit, veg, high legumes, you know, all these things that are rich in antioxidants, rich in brilliant polyphenols. They talked about increasing your omega-3s as well. They introduced coffee, which is very rich in phenolic compounds. Also interesting is curcumin they added, which is more unusual in these sort of studies, but every day in conjunction with black pepper, which increases its bioavailability by over 100%. But curcumin is known to inhibit the expression of various pro-inflammatory cytokines as well, like IL-6 and TNF-alpha. So that was kind of interesting. So they had 45 chronic pain patients. They introduced this diet over 4 months. They didn't do it. It's not a randomized controlled trial, but they did carefully measure pain perception, depression status, sleep, and quality of life issues. And it's a pilot study, so they're going to hopefully go on and do a larger study. But it did show that this anti-inflammatory diet, restricting the consumption of pro-inflammatory foods, did relieve, significantly reduce chronic pain and improve the symptoms of stress and depression as well, and improve sleep. So it is interesting because all these things are integral to your perception of pain. If you're anxious and you're producing a lot of cortisol and your HPA axis is activated, you're feeling more stressed or depressed, or your sleep's really disturbed, your perception of pain does change. And when you don't sleep, your pain perception, your experience of pain is often much worse. So I just thought it was kind of interesting. But there's not many of these studies around, and it's difficult because when I talk to my colleagues, they might say, well, Siobhan, all sounds very interesting, but where's the nice guidelines? Where's the randomized controlled trial on an anti-inflammatory diet on this type of pain, trigeminal neuralgia, for example? And they're just not that specific. So I suppose what we're doing is taking an evidence-based approach and a pragmatic approach to try and sort of think, well, look, we know a lot about the mechanisms from animal and human studies where they've measured, you know, inflammation in various circumstances after various foods or in states of dysbiosis. So we're trying to just use all the bits of the puzzle to put together a picture which is really sensible and pragmatic and not harmful, and, you know, probably hugely beneficial. And even if it doesn't affect someone's chronic pain, it will greatly improve their, you know, chances of getting other chronic diseases, or, you know, reduce their chance of diabetes, or reduce their chance of cardiovascular disease. So I just kind of think it's really important that we look at these things. I mean, what are your thoughts, and what do you advise people, and how has your chronic pain management changed?
So I think of chronic pain as being caused by inflammation. And that's what this study is showing. This study is showing that there's a big inflammatory component to this chronic pain, because what they've done is they've put people on foods that are going to reduce inflammation, like your fibrous foods, like your fruits and your vegetables, your curcumin, which comes from turmeric. From the studies that I have read on turmeric, actually whole turmeric is more effective than curcumin, the supposed active ingredient for pain. And indeed, I take turmeric every day, and have done for several years, because I have had issues with my own joints. Since my early 30s, I started getting osteoarthritis in my joints, because I've got quite hypermobile joints. So they move too much and they rub together. And my response to that is to take turmeric every day, and to also exercise so that I strengthen the muscles quite a lot, so that keeps my joints pretty healthy. And so long as I do that, I keep them fairly pain-free. And so I would agree with the turmeric, and I'd agree with the Mediterranean-style diet with the nuts and the olive oil and the lots of fruits and vegetables, because they're all very, very low in good at lowering inflammation. And all the short-chain fatty acid production, we know now that that's going to have a very anti-inflammatory effect on the brain, on the nerves. So that's going to be important as well. And hopefully then you can outcompete these horrible gram-negative microorganisms that will produce more LPS and create more inflammation.
So Sheena, just when I was talking about the diet as well, you just reminded me there, sorry to interrupt you. It's not just we're talking a lot about what we're putting into a diet. Now, just as important with the gut microbiome, as you and I know, is what you don't have in a diet. So all these things are whole food, plant-based, you know, as low processing as possible. So you're not having these ultra-processed foods full of additives, emulsifiers, you know, sweeteners, we know are very detrimental to the gut microbiome. So it's also you're not having those things which are toxic to the composition of your gut microbiome. And, you know, that's just as important. I think that's probably the main thing that links all these different diets, because we all get very confused about whether we should be completely plant-based or can you have meat or, you know, can you have this or that or the other. I think the main theme for everyone, whatever your choice of food, is the ultra processed element and reducing that, reducing the additives, reducing the emulsifiers. We are all going to benefit in whichever style we choose to, you know, to eat.
Yeah. And so this really matches with the experience that a family friend of mine had, who had rheumatoid arthritis diagnosed in her 30s. And she was told that diet made no difference back in those days. And that was, you know, 40 odd years ago. Interestingly, she decided that it did make a difference. So she decided to knock out sugar from her diet. And she decided to knock out red wine for some reason. But she also decided to knock out pork, interestingly, and dairy. So in line with this study, she'd knocked out dairy and the sugars, and she had the addition of knocking out pork and knocking out red wine. But I don't know which of these interventions was the most effective or whether it was a combination. But essentially, she resolved her rheumatoid arthritis for 30 odd years with this diet. So, you know, it can be done. I've seen it before. I've seen it with people with autoimmune conditions who have managed to go on these very anti-inflammatory diets and resolve things in the same way that, you know, when you look at visceral pain, so chronic pain and inflammation in the gut, that can be caused by inflammation, obviously, coming from, you know, harmful organisms. And I had a friend once again who with Crohn's disease, who switched to a Mediterranean style diet and has managed to resolve their Crohn's disease through a sort of very anti-inflammatory Mediterranean diet, again, getting rid of the processed foods in the diet. So, you know, it all sort of followed suit that if you can alter your gut microbiome, you can reduce inflammation within there, you can improve the harmony, you can increase your short chain fatty acid production, you improve your neurotransmitter production, you dampen down your LPS and you dampen down the toxins from these gram-negative bacteria, and of course the harmful bacteria themselves that can be very stimulating for pain, then all of this, you know, can turn around chronic pain syndrome. So I would say in my own clinical practice, I'm utilizing this knowledge and I am encouraging patients to take this approach. But also, like you say, it has to be holistic. You have to consider what else might be triggering dysbiosis of their gut and looking at their sleep and looking at their stress levels and things like this as well. But I think it's really, really important. And, you know, just as another little example, I had a patient with recurrent shingles exacerbations that kept happening. Shingles is a very painful disorder that is down to the reactivation of the herpes virus, herpes zoster virus. And what was happening is his herpes was a little bit out of control and going a bit haywire. And as a result, he was just getting episode after episode. And what I advised him to do, because he had a fairly okay diet, was to increase the ferments in his diet. So increase the lactobacilli, which would then increase his short-chain fatty acid production. And I also advised him to cut down on sugars and any processed foods and things. And his symptoms resolved.
Yeah, I think the addition of fermented food is kind of a really exciting thing. And there is evidence coming out about probiotics, particularly probiotics in particular, subtypes of IBS. But again, not on their own. It has to be part of a kind of holistic approach, as you say. But also until, you know, there's not very many studies out on probiotics and more unusual types of chronic pain, or for example, neuropathic pain. But certainly, you know, looking into this sort of anti-inflammatory diet and trying fermented foods,
You know, they're delicious. You're getting your diversity. You're improving your chances in other aspects of your health as well. So it's kind of no brainer for me. And anyone out there who's listening and thinking, oh, what does she mean? What do I take? I really, again, going back to the pain-free mindset and this diet that you know, Deepak's got a lot of really lovely information in this book about working out what your diet's like and what you should be on. And he really takes you through it step by step. So if anyone's wondering what they should do next and where they can get help, you'd be you know, well advised to have a look at that book.
Great. Well, I'm really looking forward to discussing this with him next time. Was there anything else, Siobhan, you wanted to cover before we head off today?
No, I'm, you know, I might have another look at this book before we speak to Deepak, but otherwise I will meet you when we speak to Deepak.
Excellent. All right. So thanks very much, Siobhan. That's been a really interesting discussion. I'm really excited at this area. And of course, you know, the gut-brain connection is so important, not just for pain, but also for a whole host of other disorders. And I think, you know, we might consider another episode of the podcast on this in the future after the podcast next time with Deepak, so that we can look at, for example, the relationship between the gut brain and mental health, and also things like neurodegenerative disorders and other conditions that I think are really, really important to be looking at now. So again, it's, you know, it's a similar approach with all of these things, but I think this is a really important area. And I think so many people are affected by disorders of the gut-brain axis that we need to be covering this, and we need to think about solutions that are more holistic and also more centered around the gut itself. So thanks very much. Lovely to be with you, and looking forward to the next podcast already. So thanks again. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Microbiomedics Podcast. We really hope you enjoyed the content and we welcome your feedback. We'd love to hear any suggestions you might have for microbiome topics that you'd like us to cover. And we also appreciate listeners' questions, and we'll endeavour to answer them in the next podcast.